April is National Bilingual and Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. That's why we're so excited to tell you about a new special series from Science of Reading, the podcast, that will launch later this month. Over several episodes, we'll talk to leading researchers and practitioners about how the science of reading serves multilingual and English learners, and how to best use the science of reading to support those students in the classroom. That's all starting at the end of this month. Stay tuned to this feed for more.
How do we help students become confident readers? What meaningful conversations should we have to overcome barriers to equity and inclusivity in the classroom? Welcome to Season 4 of Science of Reading, the podcast. I'm your host, Susan Lambert. This season, we're exploring important topics that impact our students every day: reading acceleration and recovery, inclusivity, and meeting students just where they're at on their reading journey. We've lined up an amazing team of experts who will inspire you as they share their perspectives to find fresh ways to help you support your students. This season, we're also honoring educators who have driven change in their district by successfully implementing the Science of Reading. You'll hear from winners of the Amplify Science of Reading Star Awards as they share their experiences fighting for students when no one else would. The Science of Reading movement continues to grow, and as educators, we will continue to grow with it. It's vital that we focus on research-based practices to deliver classroom instruction that allows students to learn. The more we learn and listen, the more we'll be prepared to lead. Our students are counting on us. Hey, listeners, before we jump into our latest episode, I want to let you know about Amplify's Science of Reading Star Awards. The short story? It's a chance for you to nominate an educator who has successfully brought the science of reading to their classroom, and they could win amazing prizes. Be sure to check out the show notes for more details. And joining me on today's episode is Sue Pimental, founding partner of Student Achievement Partners and lead author on their latest report, Reading as Liberation, an Examination of the Research Base. Sue has influenced education in so many ways as an expert in educational standards and working to advance education reform and champion proven tools for increasing academic rigor. It was so great to hear a bit about her background and to dive into this new report, which highlights evidence-based literacy practices and personalized learning as a matter of equity. Well, Sue, thank you so much for joining us on today's episode.
I'm so excited to be here and talk about this paper. I really am. It's not just like a white paper. It really is a paper full of action.
It really is full of action. And I was actually going to ask you before I hit the record button how we want to talk about this, because it's not really a report. It's not really a paper. It's not a white paper. It's not a, we'll get into it, but it's super actionable and super important. But before we do that, we love to have our listeners understand who you are, what your background is, and we, you know, for our listeners, I always do a pre-call, and in our pre-call, Sue, I remember saying to you, you know, you've been involved in the lots of development of standards across the years. And I said to you, I mean, how does one say, oh, when I grow up, I want to write standards? How did you get to this place?
Well, so I never said that at all. I will tell you, my mom would tell me that when I was young, and I remember this, I always had classrooms. I always made my dolls into classrooms. So I always wanted to get into education. And then I did. I got a teaching degree. And then sort of by a fluke, I went to law school. I thought it'd be good for my brain. And indeed it was. Did some policy work. And then I ended up meeting a very innovative school superintendent, John Murphy, who was in Prince George's County, which is right outside of DC. And he was all about what he called no victim analysis, meaning it's not about the kids not learning because they can't. It's about us not teaching them in the way they need to be taught. And then he went on to Charlotte Mecklenburg, and I didn't move with him, but he brought me in as a consultant. And so one day I walked into his office and he said, I want a set of academic standards.
Wow.
And he said, and I want you to write them for us. And this was like back in 1990. This was like no states had state standards really to speak of then. Mm-hmm. Even the national organizations, maybe NCTM did. And I said, I've never written a set. And he said, well, I want him on my desk in 30 days. So he wanted ELA set, a math set. I just was like, I said,
wow.
Okay. I know. So I said, okay, I'll do it. But when I do a draft, I have to have people in the district be able to look at them and say, yeah, this makes sense. So I went off, and because there wasn't much in the nation, I went to Canada. I looked in Canada. I looked in Europe. I looked in Asia to see what they were expecting of their students, delivered them on his desk and said, now we have to have other people chew on them. So for the next year, people chewed on them. So we had teachers chew on them. We had university people chew on them. We had business folks chew on them so we could have a set. And they were grade level, which was very, very different than any of the other standards that had sort of been around. Word got out, districts wanted me in to help them set standards, and then states started asking, and then Fordham Foundation was reviewing standards that I had helped with, and they kept getting A's, and so they took note of me. Then the American Diploma Project happened, where it was a compilation of states, about, I don't know, 35, 40 states said, why do we have different standards in different places? Can't we come together and figure out when students graduate from high school, what is it they need? So again, mm-hmm. a whole couple of years of research. And then I was asked that American Diploma Project set those out, and then I was asked to lead the Common Core State Standards in ELA and literacy. So here I am. So
amazing.
Did I, you know, think about this from when I was 5, 6, 7, 8? No.
And teachers in the classroom now, probably many of them can't remember a time when we didn't have standards.
I think that's right. And I think that what I just want to say something about standards, because sometimes they get a bad name, and I know sometimes they annoy teachers, and I understand that, but it really is making sure, and this is one thing John Murphy said, that all students who come to us, I mean, it's hard for teachers. What am I teaching my students? Am I just going to do what I think is right, or can I prepare them for the next grade? Can I prepare them for college and what's beyond? What is it I need? And so that it really is an assist to teachers to help get them focused, and that know that all teachers are working together, on the same objective. So that's the purpose. Doesn't always work that way, but that's the purpose.
That's the purpose, yeah. And I know you talk a lot about particularly ELA standards and in our conversation about CCSS, about the intention of those things to weave together. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when we had a small team that was working together, and we made a promise to teachers that we were going to focus on what mattered most. We weren't going to include every thing we could possibly find in standards across the nation. We were going to focus on what mattered most, which meant that they were going to be research-based. And so when we got feedback, and maybe some of our listeners sent in feedback, Ooh. We read every single piece. But
wow.
We insisted that if someone wanted something in, that we needed to have the research base for it. If we didn't have it, please supply it for us. So having said that, you will see when you read the standards and sort of stand back from them, there are several themes that weave through. So one of them is marshaling evidence from text. So you'll see it in the reading standards. You'll see it in the writing standards. You'll see it in the speaking and listening standards. Vocabulary development, so important for students' ability to read and write. Again, it floats through the reading standards, the writing standards, speaking, listening standards, and the language standards. Complex text, the ability to handle complex text. Again, most centrally in the reading standards, but in the writing standards, you're supposed to write about those texts. In the speaking and listening standards, you're supposed to be able to speak to one another about those texts. So those, in a way, are precursor. I should mention foundational skills. Okay, that doesn't weave through everything, but it is a foundation for everything that comes. So those were the main impetus in terms of writing the standards, so that they focused on what teachers would need to focus on, rather than have this wide ranging, you name it, grab bag of stuff.
And you're seeing too, as you're looking at states that are moving away from CCSS to their own standards, you're seeing some of the elements of those things like hang with. Is that right?
Yeah. So the core has held. I mean, I think it is fine. And it was actually the intention of the CCSS that as we provided a core, that states could add in things that they felt were really important. And we took a lot of heat on not adding in cursive writing. We had a reason for that, but a lot of states added that in. That's terrific. But when you look across the states, they call them something different. They may organize them differently into different domains. They may have made improvements in ways. I can see ways to make improvements. So, we think that's really good. But the core mostly has held, I think, across the nation. And that means complex text. It means drawing evidence from text. It means vocabulary development. And it means deep comprehension of complex text. So those have held. And writing to text, by the way, doing a whole lot more writing, period, but writing to text.
Yeah, that's great. And I love that background because I think it helps our listeners understand where you come from in terms of the work that you did prior to this like moment right now with this amazing new, what are we calling it? A report?
Yeah, I know. Like, so it feels flat. It could feel like a white paper because it does go through, you know, it does analyze the research and put it together compactly. But it really is, it tells you the what, then it tells you the how, that what and why, and then it tells you how. And it also pulls together some different elements that we haven't talked about yet. When I say we, I mean Student Achievement Partners hadn't really talked about, which was personalization and then weaving equity all the way through.
Yeah. And so for our listeners, the thing, this report that we're talking about is called Reading as Liberation, an Examination of the Research Base. And it came out February of this year. I have it right in front of me here. So but I just want to set this up for one thing, and then I want to hear from you what the motivation was, why this moment, why these pieces coming together. But I'm going to read just one sentence from
yes.
it. It says, so too, the disruption has created an environment ripe for new opportunities to reset how we do things to make literacy instruction more effective for all students. And this is one of the first sentences in this report. And you are right out front with the importance and the urgency. So set this up for us a little bit.
Yeah.
How did this come to be?
Yeah. So just as you said, so on the one hand, the pandemic led us to the fact that time is a scarce commodity. It probably was always, but especially now with school closures and things in and out and virtual learning and all the like, right? So there was that. Then there was this sense of the maybe silver lining, which is, it pulled the curtain back on the fact that we have some kids that are doing really well and there are other students who are not being served. And with this disruption, we had to do things differently. So are there other ways for us to do things differently? Mm-hmm. And so when we were looking at that, we had been in sort of our cone or our silo in Student Achievement Partners on like high quality instructional materials, which we still believe in. But there was also this sort of force out there, this new energy around personalization, which we really hadn't done much with, which we really hadn't looked at. And we said, well, is there a way for personalization to work with high quality instructional materials to the benefit of students? So in other words, the personalization piece could accelerate the literacy accelerators. And then also this new urgency around equity and this sense that we can't, you know, and that's in the instructional materials and in any personalization. We know some kids are getting the good stuff and some kids are not. And are there ways for us to really attend to that? So there was a sense that there were three parts coming together, or really two parts coming together undergirded by equity, which is what is the core instructional program and what is personalization and how can they work together? Because there was a sense that personalization was over here. You either personalized or you had a core and you never brought them together. Hmm. And I think, you know, when we had our original talk, I said I was a personalization skeptic.
I was.
But I changed. Provided it's done in a way that supports and advances the right content and other things as well.
Yeah, we'll get into the details of personalization in a few minutes here, but it's sort of I can be a little bit of a skeptic of that too, because it turned into a word, I think, sort of like differentiation, where it sounds like, of course we do that, right? Of course. But really, does anybody really know what we mean by it anymore?
Well, that's true. And the other thing is, and I've been scolded people about this, but in the name of personalization, it can be a name for tracking students.
Oh, yes.
Or siloing students in lower level work because, oh gosh, we're personalizing it. Now, that is not what personalization experts mean. That is not what they want it to be. But it is easy to say, well, gosh, you know, this student can't read very well, so I'm going to put them in a lower level text. We're never going to. So there is a danger. And from our equity expert, Tanji Reid Marshall said, you know, that's one of the most important things is, what are you advancing the right content? Are you moving all students to grade level work? And are you watching how you're assigning certain students to certain content? And to be very, very careful about that, because, you know, we're all human beings and we all have biases, or sometimes we use tests that don't really tell us what we think, especially in reading. It's very hard to tell. Yeah. So there was those cautions, I think, too, about personalization.
That's
that
great.
I held, and then we looked at it.
Well, we'll get into that and find out why you turned into less of a skeptic than what you were before. But this report really, so we're also going to talk about the organization of it later too, and give some advice about how to move through it. But really, you talk about three things. You talk about literacy accelerators, the personalized learning, and the equity. Yep. So let's start with this literacy accelerators. And I think this is a new term. This report uses this term. I've never heard it before.
Yes.
So why do we call them literacy accelerators, and what are those things?
Yes. So we call them literacy accelerators because they have a massive, and I mean a massive research base behind them. So what you need to know, and don't get scared about reading the report, it summarizes, it was 500 studies, right?
Yes.
So their support for foundational skills, which we've known for gobs of years now, from the National Reading Panel report onward. The importance of knowledge, building students' knowledge, which if you look at the research, has been around for decades as well. So all of that research, how do we come to this? What do they know? What do we know about knowledge? Expanding vocabulary, which is very closely tied to building knowledge, but really important to focus on. And then we also know, and some of this is maybe some of this is newer research, and some of this is also hearing from college professors and the like about how important it is for students to be able to write about what they read in a cogent manner. And that when we do, when I have to write about something that I've read, I have to know it better to communicate to you. I have to think through how do I say this to you in a way that you can understand it? And that means also both in discussion. So it actually makes me understand better. And then there's this whole sort of reading comprehension, which sort of encompasses it all. But it really is about being able to comprehend increasingly complex texts. And to be able to do that in a way that I can draw inferences, knowing what to pay attention to, what not to pay attention to, what are the key details that make that. And students need practice with that. They need a lot of practice and support with that. So those are the five: foundational skills, knowledge, vocabulary, writing and communicating about what you're reading, and then this notion of reading comprehension of complex texts.
And why did you choose that word accelerators again? I just want to
because these are the five, and maybe there's someone else who said, oh, there's another, but those are the five that have the solid research base that says when students can, when you work on these five with students, if you stripped everything else away, your students are going to become strong readers and writers. And that's something, other point I want to make, that I think the paper does come across when you read even the individual sections. These are not, I think I'll work on knowledge and, you know, I'll forget the rest. What it really is they are mutually interdependent, that they boost one another. And when you read through the analyses, the research analyses, you'll see that we pick up the oftentimes pick up the other, accelerators because they're key to knowledge building or they're key to writing and communicating about text. So there's a way that they move together. And I think, you know, if we have English language arts teachers listening, they know that this is the case, right? You actually probably couldn't even do one without many of the others. But to think about doing them as a way. And then I want to say this. So one of the things we say in the paper is that get a good set of curriculum materials that integrate these five. Mm. They're out there. High quality. They're out there. So let's get going on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Materials do matter in the classroom.
And they help the teacher who then can, you know, make adjustments when he or she needs to make adjustments or do whatever. But the core is there. And again, back to that compress time, strip away the stuff that doesn't matter as much, what the research doesn't tell us, and use these. And you can do the core instructional materials, then plus personalization.
Hmm, that's great. And so this harkens back to a theme that you were talking about with standards, right? The idea that they weave through each other, one through each other, and they should not be done in isolation, but we should think of them coherent.
Think of them together. And that was one of the things that when we were writing the paper, we wanted to make really clear about the interdependence between them and how they can bolster one another. So even though they have their own section, you will see that we make references back and forth and all together because there's some real power there.
Hmm. So when I was reading through this report, essentially the literacy accelerators, like you talk about them, is like, oh, I get that. I know that. It's not necessarily new. It's maybe the way that you frame them in terms of accelerators. But to use them then as the foundation or the framework for personalization, that's sort of the next step, right?
That's the next step. So when we started looking at personalization, and we had personalization researchers, you know, that's their research, is what they do. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that surprised me the most, and this came from the personalization researchers, there's hardly any evidence. There's hardly any efficacy research. Now, that doesn't mean that it's bad or can't be helpful, but there's a whole big need for real research here. But what we said was, huge research on what matters in literacy.
Yeah.
So we'll use that research to then think about what personalization practices, what personalization approaches, both human and tech enabled, could then accelerate the accelerator. So we base it on the accelerator research to then think about, well then what do you personalize? Because up to this point, I think a lot of personal vendors who are putting personalization products together. I don't know all of what they're basing it on. Maybe a client says they need this or they need mm-hmm. that. But we mm-hmm. said best to spend your money and spend your time if you're putting them together yourself. And again, it can be human or tech enabled to think about how will this accelerate the accelerator itself.
Yeah.
So that's kind of throughout the paper. The other aspect I want to say, which I came to really appreciate about personalization is that it's an opportunity to build on students' interests and student agency, to allow students to think about not just all on their own, or they can do it, but sort of a co-agency, I would say. So you've got a core instructional unit, and then you can allow students, you know, depending upon what they need or what they can do, to maybe choose what they want to read some more about or research about. Or there's lots of ways if students are having trouble inferencing to give them some more inferencing practice on other sorts of text. So there are lots of ways to have personalization, you know, come in and be part of where you're dealing with student interest and student agency along with. Now, as you suggested, and as you said, which I think is so important, is that what students are studying in class, the personalization has to fit with that. It shouldn't just be like something separate, or you go sit students at a computer and say, okay, now do this. It has nothing to do with what it is they're supposed to be learning. So it really needs to advance the right content, Students have to be able to feel like it's interesting. You know, Tim Shanahan, great literacy expert, said, you know, as adults, we think, oh, this will be lots of fun. You know, I'll be really interested in this. And then turns out, not so much. So how do we know from, you know, that students are really interested in it? Because remember, they have to be self-motivated here. So what's happening here? And then there's the whole equity piece of how I attended to that, and what in the personalization practice itself or the personalization approach itself has built equity in from the start. And the last thing I want to say is that really I will stop is that it should be a slice of what students do. It shouldn't be the whole of what students do, because learning is really a social enterprise. I learn from you, you learn from me, we learn together. And so, yes, it's great to do follow my interest and have some agency over what else I do, but also together we get better and we get stronger and we learn more. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. And you're really clear in this report that by personalization, I'm going to read the definition that you have in here in a minute, but by personalization, you're not talking about an activity or a thing. It's really an approach to instruction, again, that extends what's happening in the classroom.
That's right. Because oftentimes I think I was guilty of this myself. When I thought of personalization, my immediate thought went to students sitting at a computer. Now, that can be personalization, but students sitting at a computer going at their own pace and doing whatever it is they're doing.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to do, there are many definitions out there on personalization, but we wanted to take one that said, no, this is an approach you take that's connected to the right content. And it's about advancing students into grade level work. And that's what we're talking about here. So it's a broad definition, but it's also one that we thought, as we looked and read and talked to personalization experts, that it worked.
Yeah. It's really beautiful because you include in here, and I'll have, you know, folks can read the definition themselves, but what's included in here is it's an approach, which teaching and other learning experience build on students' strengths.
Yes, very good.
Address their needs, spur motivation and agency, and help them meet grade level standards.
Yes.
And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that is, if people were out there thinking about, gosh, I want to personalized part of the instructional delivery that we have, to think about those different elements. And I will tell you, Susan, that in the appendix, there's an appendix that talks about some consideration questions to think about as you think about both your core instructional program and how do you make personalization coherent with that, coherent together. And so it includes many of those aspects, which I think could be a help to people in the audience.
So let me ask you this question then. Why were you a skeptic and why are you no longer as much of a skeptic?
So I was a skeptic because, as you said, I think yourself, it's like, well, it sounds real good.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, let's personalize learning in all situations and let's just do that. But I also knew, as you said, that differentiating instruction is really tough.
Yeah.
When a teacher is faced with 30, 35 students, 20, I mean, really tough to do well for all students. Then there was this notion of, oh, I've personalized instruction for you, Sue, because you can't read very well. So you're just going to have low level text, you know, or I'm going to sit you over at a computer and I don't know what you're going to be practicing over there, but whatever it is, you're out of the mainstream. So I had just, I had seen sort of people talk about it in that regard. Oh, well, I'm meeting their needs. Now, I don't think there's no maliciousness in that, right? There's just a sense of like, well, that's where they are. So that's where we're going to be, as opposed to what we know about the research, which is if students are provided challenging work, even if a test kind of says it's above their level, they tend to rise to that. Okay. And there's lots and lots of research that tells us that. So I was skeptical that way. And I was skeptical because it sounds so good, but how do you do it and how do you do it well? And then what changed my mind about it was that we didn't look at like personalization as like this separate and apart thing, like go do good personalization somehow where no one's involved with the content. It's just like, how snazzy can it be? Like, how, you know, does it look like, woo, kids are going to be excited about this without any sort of notion about, well, what's it going to teach them? How is it going to promote grade level work? So once I found that what we could talk about, and I think this is helpful for folks that are developing any sort of personalization programs, that they think about, oh, well, we can tie it to, we can be driven by the right content. Mm-hmm. And so then I thought, well, yeah, that's wonderful, because it also offers, especially if it includes student agency, if it includes the right practice on the right stuff, then I think it can be a real boost. And I think students like a piece of doing that when that's taken into consideration. And I think, just to say it, that teachers, if you put in a personalization approach or you put something together, important to ask your students how it's going. Do they like it? Yeah. is it doing something for them? Because if it's not, stop and move on.
Yeah, that's important. Not to keep reading sentences from this report, yes, but I have another one that I highlighted that I really think will sort of bring this to life. It says, we share this enthusiasm, but our findings from the personalization research make it clear that personalization must be driven by, yep, and in service of the content being taught, in this case, each literacy accelerator.
Drop the mic, yes.
It kind of is a mic drop, because when I think or thought of personalization, it could almost be inequitable instructional practices in the classroom if you're not careful. And I think you made mention of that, like, here, you know, I'm sorry, Sue, you're not reading very well, so I'm going to give you these low-level activities. And that can be very inequitable.
Very inequitable, because it was interesting, because even the personalization experts said that it's a big challenge for teachers to differentiate, and it's also very easy to be inequitable.
Hmm.
That you make decisions on you may not know you're doing this, but make decisions based on how students look or how they talk or whatever else it is. And, or one test, a single test,
yeah,
or something like that. So it's really important. But if you keep it based on advancing the right content and moving all students to grade level work, it doesn't mean you can do away with any of those biases. And I just want to say that it isn't like I think people are out to be biased.
Yes.
It's just that we are. And I'll have to get you the research citation, but I think it was done, I don't know if it was Sweden or Netherlands or something like that. And they gave teachers student results on reading tests.
Okay.
And so they had students who were high, students who were medium, and students who were low. And then they gave a profile of the students, whether they came from really, really poor homes or, you know, well-to-do homes or whatever. And they repeated it several times. And each time, it wasn't based as much on the reading scores as it was on whether the students came from a well-to-do home, an okay home, or a very poor home. So, and they did it, it was fake, you know, they did these fake reports and said, where would you place these students? And so, and you could see that teachers might think, well, gosh, you know, the student comes from a home that doesn't have a lot of books. A student comes from a home where both parents are working a gazillion jobs. Of course, they're going to need more of something else that's, or something like that that goes on. So when you see research like that, it's rather frightening. But if you, again, if it advances the right content, and you can really rethink, you know, how you're assigning students and then what you're assigning them to, I think we can at least get a lot of that out of the way.
Yeah, maybe that's a good segue then to talk a little bit about this equity piece and what you included and what you found. I think you said earlier that you sort of see equity running through or like undergirding both of these literacy accelerators and the personalization.
Yes. Because so when you read in the executive summary, what we talk in terms about equity. So the first thing is care in how you're assigning, on what basis you're assigning students to certain level of content. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we take a single test and we think that defines the child or defines the student, and we have to be really, really careful about that. The second thing is students have to feel safe and respected. And they have to know, kids know, students know, if we're respecting their brains or not. Do we think they're up for it? And sometimes it's okay to say to kids, this is going to be really hard.
Yeah.
It's okay that it's hard. That's the whole point. And I'm going to be right there with you. So kids know that, I think. And so making it sort of a safe and respectful. So that gets into also how you assign students what you assign them to. There has to be a trust relationship between mm-hmm. the student and the teacher, that they know they're safe and respected. They know that you believe in them. And then the other point is thinking about that equity can't be an afterthought of the approach you're using. So, you know, we have to think about ways to affirm students' identities. And yes, you know, racial identities, certainly, you know, other sorts of identities too. You're a boy, you're a girl. Mm-hmm. Like I listened to my granddaughter say, I won't use her word, blanks in math. And she has no confidence in herself there. Whereas my grandson thinks he's quite wonderful in math. Now, I don't know, that could just be what their natural abilities are, where things seem to come more easily or what they're more interested in. But that follows a pattern, right? Science and math, boys, you know, reading and writing, mm-hmm. girls. So, yeah. So we have to think about how do we affirm students' identities and what we're giving them to do, and that it can't just be, an afterthought. And so that's something else to ask if you're purchasing either core materials or personalization materials to assist, to talk to the vendors about what kind of equity research went into this, who are these materials working well for, where haven't they been tried out? So you don't know. So those are really good questions to ask in terms of equity.
Hmm. Here's another mic drop statement. You have several of these in here. Like, it's just amazing. It says, collectively, we must stop identifying students as the thing to fix and mend the learning environment to empower students to prosper. Oh, that idea of mending the learning environment, those words together give me goosebumps.
Well, you know, that harkens me back to my great mentor, John Murphy, who said, he used to say, parents are sending the best kids they have to school.
I've heard that.
It is our job. It is our job to educate them. And if there's something we're not, if they're having trouble in some respect, then we have to change what it is we're doing. We have to alter what it is we're doing. We have to figure out what supports we need or what we're doing. It's not them, it's us. We have the responsibility. Yeah. And I think that that says it. It's not a, you know, it's mending ourselves.
Yeah. And this moment really, I mean, a perfect time to do that, right? Like we've always had these struggles, right? We've always had gaps. Like literacy has been a crisis in the nation for a long time, but this moment highlights it and magnifies the issues that we have. And I love that you've put this report in the context of, let's use this as a time to course correct. We may never have this opportunity again.
Right. Where it, like you said, it showed so plainly, almost daily, that there were the haves and have nots. And also that there may be different ways to organize learning. I mean, this is off of the paper, but I'll use my grandkids as an example. So my grandson loved virtual learning.
Mm.
He loved it because he said, I can learn and get my work done in a couple of hours. I don't need 6 hours to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my granddaughter, very social, really needs the social aspects of learning, struggled through the virtual learning that she had to do. And so I think that one of the things that we can think about when we think about personalization in a way is, well, what can we offer students? What's the variety that we can offer students to allow them to grow and thrive? and a sense too of let's stop fooling ourselves about if we just do what we've always done, which was the point around the paper, which is to say, well, how can we take these, what I would call too exciting things, is core instructional materials that are high quality, that follow the research, that are stripped down to what's really important and show what's, you know, get into it. And then how do we take the sense in teachers and educators that, gosh, if we could personalize a piece of learning so students feel like what they're learning is especially relevant to what they want to learn as well. And not giving kids too much choice. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about it as being sort of within the units that they're studying. How do we give students choice and the like? That if we could pull those together, there could be a way of making learning much better. And then there's new research that says, and I was, so way back when, because I've been at this for decades, there was rigor in learning.
Yeah.
And then there was social emotional learning.
Mm-hmm.
And again, never the twain should meet, really. And yeah. I was on the rigor side. I was like, okay, I want kids to feel good, but I want them to learn what they need to learn, because when they get out, they got to, And what I have turned to understand is that's not an either or either. That's a both and.
Mm.
So when students are feeling supported and respected and affirmed in their identities, it gives them the opportunity to take risks. It gives them the opportunity to be wrong. It gives them the opportunity to struggle and be supported in that. So it's a huge component of students learning what it is we want them to learn and rigor. So I learned through experience on that one too.
We all grow, don't we?
We do.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you organized this report, because and maybe some advice for folks on how to read it, because it's not a linear read. You probably don't want to read it from start to finish like I
do. I know. I mean, it's a lot of pages. Let's be clear.
It is.
But here's the deal. Like you can, if what I would recommend, but it depends who you are and what your interest is. I would probably read the executive summary. I don't know. It's four, maybe five pages.
Yeah, not
I don't
that
know.
Long.
Correct me on that. Not that long. We'll set out kind of what are the elements we're talking about? How do we want to be able to connect them? Then there is some on personalization. So if you don't know a lot about personalization, or it's been this sort of vague notion, or, oh, I'm really interested in it. However, there's some real background in that. But it's like a couple pages long. It's not long. Then make a decision. So sometimes you might want to start in the appendices. So the appendices are really a how-to. They give you, well, how do I make decisions about what I do with my instructional materials, and how do I make my what personalization approaches do I want to include? What are the considerations for that? There's also some way, if you're using a particular curriculum and it doesn't have this, what you might do to include some personal. So it's very concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would say, you know, on the analyses, don't be afraid of them. you know, we had, you know, David Lieben, who did a lot of the research behind taking these 500 studies, but then Meredith Lieben and I took them and made them understandable to ourselves so we could make them understandable to you, hopefully. So I think they're quite readable, and within each analysis, and you don't have to read them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, say I'm really interested in knowledge building. You know, mm-hmm. I know people say it's important, but I want to kind of understand the research behind it. And then I want to understand, okay, I know what I need to do in my core instructional program. What can I then do and add in personalization? So we bring in some personalization practice. They are not meant to be exhaustive, but they are meant to give you a good idea. And they are based on what we know works.
Mm.
So it's just personalized. So it's very, very concrete. So, and I think people can use it as a resource over time. Like, I want to read a bit of it, and then, oh gosh, you know, I see my students are struggling with, I don't feel like their vocabulary is growing in the way I want, you know, to grow vocabulary. My program does some with it, but maybe there are other things I can do. So what are those, and what, you know, what else should I connect it up with? So, you know, you were very brave to read it from beginning to end.
Or crazy. Maybe that's crazy.
Crazy, right. But you can go in, and then depending who you are, right? So, you know, if you're an administrator, there might be pieces in the appendices in particular that you want to look at in terms of choices of materials. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a teacher, depending upon at what level, you know, if I'm a K-2, K-3 teacher, you know, I want to make sure I'm looking at foundational skills in particular, and what they're saying about that, about the quality of them, the quantity of them, and what needs to happen, and how they build on each other, and how important they are to everything else, and what does that look like? Hmm. And personalization, if I could just say, in foundational skills, there's a ton of things to do. That's a place where I would say personalize, because students grow in different sort of starts and stops and spurts and whatever else it is. And it's a great place to give students practice on that. And the last thing I'll say about that is that sometimes we think, oh gosh, practice in foundational skills, big yawn, big, you know. But I gotta tell you, whether you've watched your own kids or someone else's kids, when they are able to crack the code,
yeah,
it is like, whoa, the world has opened up for me. So we, again, as adults, it's easy for us sometimes to take what we think about something versus what, and there's lots of exciting games and puzzles and things for students to do in foundational skills. It's mm-hmm. It's not drudgery, and it certainly isn't drudgery for them, because they know a lot gets unlocked when they
yeah, have done. That's a really good point. I appreciate that. And one thing I'll say about each section, you can take it as a professional learning opportunity, because you've included, I mean, those 500 references are throughout each section. You'll have a reference section, so you can dig into your heart's desire.
That's exactly right. And that's why, you know, I think we were struggling to call what it is. It's not a white paper. It truly is not. It does condense things for you in a way, but then tells you, okay, now what? Or who cares? Because I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm reading research, it's kind of like, okay, great. And I've heard this from many practitioners. Okay, great. Well, now what do I do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And hopefully this paper begins to answer that question, or at least help you with the questions you should be asking.
Yeah. And what I love about it is it's reorganized in a fresh new way that's really got some urgency behind it. So it's perfect and critical for this moment. So I don't know, I'll probably tell you other times, thank you so much for the work that you did on this. It's great.
It was a group effort. I need to say that. It was definitely a group effort.
Yeah. The best work always is. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I would love to just close, you know, I don't know, when I was a kid, I was always taught that you write the title to things last after you do all the authoring of it. So I thought we'd talk about the title of this report last, because it's called Reading as Liberation. Yeah. And I'd love to know why that particular word. Where did liberation come from? Because we hear reading is important, or reading is fun, and, you know, talk to us a little bit about this liberation.
So that came from a member of our team, Tanji Reed Marshall, who's with EdTrust, and she was our leading equity expert. And, you know, I think she said to us very plainly, reading is liberation. And that made us sit up. What does that mean? And she says it's about self-preservation. She said, reading is power and gives you access. And she used her own experiences and what in the Black community, she said, you know, you can talk about reading as being fun and joyful, and you can talk about, oh, we want to instill in students the love of reading. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But for my community, she says, it's about power and access. And if you don't read well, you are going to be cut off. And it was so striking to us. And we said, that is exactly right. That if you learn to read, yes, it can be fun. Yes, it can be joyful. But it also gives students options. It makes them independent thinkers and learners, and to preserve their dreams. And that's, you know, certainly she was responding to sort of our history in this country with our Black citizenry and, you know, what we've kept them from and what we haven't allowed them to do and to think. But she said it's so important for kids to understand that reading is liberation and it's about self-preservation. And we said, that's it. And so we actually had the title.
You had the title first, maybe, huh?
We did have the title first because we knew that, and it was something that was sort of embedded in us. And I think all of my work over the years, you know, I did know that reading, what, you know, if students can't read well, God bless. I mean, you know, oh my goodness, what a life, like how hard and tough it is. But it was so stark when she said it.
Yeah.
About, and also I think trusting students to tell them that reading is liberation, reading is power. In our society, in our culture, it's about power and freedom when you learn how to read. So that's, we have Tangi Reid Marshall, the brilliant Tangi Reid Marshall, to thank for the inspiration.
That's
for
amazing.
The title and the paper.
And I will say one more time, I mean, I think this is just a brilliant piece. And I get the sense, even going back and rereading it just for this, to record this episode, words are carefully and deliberately chosen. And I really encourage our listeners to get at least to the executive summary and just let the essence of that message come in, because I think the urgency for this moment, wrapped in the potential and the opportunity, is just brilliant. So thank you.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, we tried to make it in very plain text. It won't read like a research paper.
It does not read like a research paper, for sure. Well, Sue, it was just a pleasure to have you on, to tap into your brain a little, to hear a little bit about this report, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad you've showcased the report, because people can think, oh, 90 pages of like, what? You know, so this has been great.
Yep. And we will link our listeners in the show notes too, so that they'll have a direct link so that they can get right to it. And thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and keep your feedback coming. Want to learn more? Be sure to stay connected by subscribing to your favorite podcast app and join our Facebook discussion group, Science of Reading the Community. And visit amplify.com to check out our brand new resource site, offering all the tools and tips you need to continue on your Science of Reading journey. Until next time, keep the hope, take the action, and stay in touch. Let's get our kids to love reading.